In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
That's what we were told. Most Americans never believed Lee Oswald was the lone gunman, for excellent reasons. In fact, there were at least six shooters who fired from 8 to 10 shots or more who are identified here. We have, finally, the solution to the greatest murder mystery in history, laid out for the world to see, proof after proof after proof. Photos were faked, the body was changed, x-rays were altered, the home movies were fixed. 15 experts contribute to a 529-page book with 1,037 photos and diagrams in black and white and color.
Hi, this is Gary King. If you'd like JFK, Who, How, and Why, and would like to support the new JFK show, then go to PatriotRadioBooks.com. That's PatriotRadioBooks.com.
All right, welcome to the new JFK show number 161. It's a very, very sad day in the JFK community today. We have Jim Morris has passed away, and almost everyone I've talked to is in almost literal tears. So, Larry, I want you to go ahead and talk about Jim Morris for a little bit, if you don't mind. And
I can talk about Jim Morris, you know, for a little bit here, but Jim Fetzer, you know, who had many experiences with Jim Morris for over the years, you know, with conferences and everything and radio shows that they would do together, you know, and, you know, trying to propagate, you know, the fact that Lee Oswald was a scapegoat, you know, with JFK assassination. And Jim Morris, you know, from day one, he never stopped fighting, you know, for Lee Oswald's innocence, you know, and justice for JFK. You know, and my very last thought about Jim Morris was in this at this past JFK conference in Dallas at Judy Baker's conference, and we had a little get together. You know, at the end, you know, on the Saturday night, you know, in Lorian's suite, you know, and Jim and other people that were there, you know, and Jim came up to me and said, you know, that was a great job that you did, you know, with the man in the doorway, you know, and that's just something, you know, that's going to be with me forever, you know. This is a day that we have to honor the memory of Jim Morris for, you know, especially, you know, his book, you know, Crossfire, which was used, you know, by Oliver Stone, you know, as a model, you know, for his movie. And we're going to talk about this, you know, for the next hour here, you know, and I'll just let Jim, you know, add a couple of comments here.
Well, Jim Morris was an old-fashioned reporter. He was a real investigative journalist, which is an all-but-extinct species in the United States today, where the media has turned into an organ of propaganda and disinformation from the New York Times, the Washington Post, on down, ABC, CBS, NBC, not to mention CNN and MSNBC, which are stellar in their exhibition of total bias. You might as well change CNN to CIA. Jim Morris was a guy who cut through all the crap. He got down to brass tacks. He did spent a lot of time that you'd call shoe leather, interviewing witnesses, tracking things down. As Larry has observed, his book, A Crossfire, along with Jim Garrison's On the Trail of the Assassination, were the bases for Oliver Stone's magisterial work, JFK, which would surely have won the Academy Award for Best Picture had not Jack Valenti, a former aide to Lyndon Johnson who became the czar of Hollywood, campaigned actively against it. That was the only reason. Instead, it went to a film about a sadistic cannibal entitled Silence of the Lamb, a simply completely absurd choice in relation to what Oliver Stone accomplished here. Jim Morris and I had many collaborations, as Larry has observed, perhaps the most important having been framing the Patsy, the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, where we went through the evidence for the backyard photographs, building on the prior work of Jack White, introducing work by Judith Berry Baker, to explain that this man in the backyard photographs was not Lee Oswald, but rather, precisely as he told Will Fritz, someone else's body with his face pasted on it. We've proven that to be the case. Jack and Judith have made extremely important contributions, and Jim had the perceptivity to observe that the man in the backyard photographs had a funny lump on his right wrist. And in fact, it turns out that Roscoe Hoy, who has also been identified as Badge Man, who appears to have participated in the assassination in Dallas, who was a Dallas cop with ties to the CIA, had exactly the same bump. He was right height, weight, and so forth to stand in for Lee Oswald. So I think we even nailed the perp in that case, who was involved in staging these phony photographs, which one of which even appeared on the cover of Life magazine, which was itself deeply involved with the CIA. When Carl Bernstein published his book, The CIA and the Media and Rolling Stone, in 1977, he cited high officials boasting that their greatest successes had been with Time, Life, the New York Times, and CBS. In those days, if you controlled those outlets, you pretty much had a lock on American media. Remember Dan Rather, who gave the completely misleading report about the Zapruder film. I've tried to vindicate him, at least in part, because in the original film, Jack was hit in the back of the head and did slump forward, but then Jackie was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangibular exploding bullet that blew his brains out the back of his head with such force that when he impacted with Officer Bobby Hargis riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot and then slumped to the left. Somehow Rather's description of violent forward motion was inconsistent with the film any way you cut it. So there's a CBS contribution. We had, of course, Time Life doing everything it could to promote the idea that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin, which you, Larry, and Ralph Sinquet have so brilliantly dispatched, and where the New York Times, of course, has turned into a shadow of its former self. I'll only conclude by saying one of the greatest compliments of my life was when Jim Mars said to me, and I'm sure there must have been witnesses present, that I knew as much about JFK as he did. Our approaches were completely different. Mine was from the scientific, medical, photographic, ballistic evidence working up scientifically. Jim was putting together the picture holistically using public sources and interviews to figure out what had happened, who was responsible, and why. In the end, we concluded, and I believe he agreed with this, that Lyndon Johnson had been the pivotal player in the assassination, where Edgar, of course, managed the cover-up, but Lyndon was the principal in bringing it all about with the assistance, of course, of the CIA. We have identified many of the shooters, and where George Herbert Walker Bush appears to have coordinated a hit team there, and Edward Lansdale have positioned the shooters and determined the sequence of shots. Jim Mars made tremendous contributions to understanding the assassination of JFK, for which we honor and revere him on this very sad occasion.
Yeah, he wasn't just into JFK. He had many books, Rule by Secrecy, Rise of the Fourth Reich. He even delved into some honest research about UFOs.
I like the Aurora incident that he covered, you know, so brilliantly. You know, that was, you know, you just can't refute that. You know, I don't know if you guys know about the Aurora, you know, in 1897, you know, about the spaceship that went and clipped the windmill and everything, you know.
Very important. You're making very important additions. If you go to Amazon.com and look for his books and a bio sketch, as the two of you are observing, he covered a vast range of subjects. JFK was only the one for which he was most noted, but you're absolutely right, Gary and Larry. He did a tremendous amount of research in areas where most others fear to go, fear to tread. Jim Mars was there. He was often there in the first round and making important contributions across the board.
Excellent. And of course, with his trademark fedora.
Yeah. And, of course, with his trademark fedora. You got it, Larry.
I did get a chance to talk to Jim Mars personally, and I just had to ask him, and I did. I said, do you believe there was a coup d'etat in 1963? And he said, well, of course. And I said, well, it wasn't the Russians and it wasn't Cuba. And I said, what about Israel? And he looked at me, he said, you're right. And we spoke about dual citizenship, and he just completely agreed with me in every way. And don't forget that Michael Collins Piper believes that Jim Mars made the data dump with all the connections within Dallas.
Well, Gary, remember, we have more than 15 indications of the Secret Service setting him up for the hit. We have multiple shots from multiple shooters. We know Ed Lansdale, George H.W. Bush were there on the scene that day. We know the body was stolen from Parkland and taken where? To Walter Reed. They had to get it under medical control. A couple of medical pathologists conducted an autopsy for which they were singularly unqualified to carry out. We know the body was altered physically. They even took a cranial saw to the skull of JFK to enlarge the wound at the back of the head. The throat wound was enlarged from a small, clear, clean puncture wound to something that looked like a gaping hole that might have been the effect of a bullet from behind. We know that the autopsies were altered to conceal the blowout at the back of the head. And, of course, the whole movies were changed. Israel, frankly, could not have done those things. This is talking about a deep complicity of the American military that threw in with Lyndon Johnson and the Secret Service to take him out. Israel was indeed a sponsor, may have had a shooter, but there were many of others representing the Dallas Police Department, the Dallas Sheriff's Department, the U.S. military, Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman. I mean, we know a great deal about this. And they had a strong motive. JFK and David Ben-Gurion were at loggerheads.
No, you've covered a lot. You've covered a lot there. You know, I just want to say that Jim Mars was an investigator that from day one, you know, the first thing that he did was he collected all the newspapers, you know, for the entire weekend. And as he progressed and he graduated, you know, from newspaper business, he had access to a lot of different individuals who had been witnesses to the assassination or who knew people, you know, so he was able to really get involved, you know, and penetrate, you know, all those different areas, you know, nooks and crannies, and that people who were not from Dallas were able to get involved with, you know. Jim, would you agree that he had that kind of situation there in Dallas?
Yeah. He was a good man. He had a great run. We hold him in the highest esteem on a multiplicity of counts. And I think it's wonderful that we're having the opportunity to discuss on this sad occasion his many contributions across the board on so many different subjects.
Well, for example, just his relationship with Marguerite Oswald is just the price of the ticket, you know, because he knew Marguerite Oswald for a long time, for a decade, at least a decade or so. And from the
Gene Hill as well, just as well.
Yeah. And you know, Marguerite told him from the beginning, that's Lee Oswald in the doorway there, you know, in the altar seat.
Now, yeah, and let's not forget, this is what I want to tell every researchers mostly, is that Jim Mars was in the OIC. And so everyone holding out about Lee in the doorway, this man here was probably our highest, most esteemed researcher that we had in the OIC.
Well, I would like to mention that Jim came about, you know, later on, you know, as, you know, the computerized techniques that came about in identifying the man in the doorway. And Jim was swayed, you know, by that type of research, you know, but Jim, you know, from, you know, at the end, you know, he even said, you know, look, Marguerite told me all along that it was Lee in the doorway, but only now is technology being able to prove that it was Lee in the doorway.
And it was a terrific guy, and he showed a great deal of appreciation for what others were doing. Your contributions among many, Judas as well, and he was just a super good guy. Gary, out of a sense of grief, no doubt, forgot to begin our hourglass.
So, no, it's been running. It's been
running. Has it? Okay, yeah. I figure we're about 15 minutes in, but
yeah, we're 15 minutes in. It's been terrific. Working like a charm.
Good work. Sure. All right. Now we all agreed beforehand that Jim would have wanted us to proceed with the business of pursuing the investigation of the death of JFK. So,
now on the eve of, you know, this trove of documents that we're starting to really get our teeth into, Jim. You know, I think it's incredible. You know. And Jim would have loved to just, hey, guys, just keep doing what you're doing, you know, and history is going to prove that you guys are right.
There's no question about it. Now, this document blew me away. Dr. Fester, do you think you can read the actual document of Earl Cabell and the CIA?
Well, this is actually his 201 file.
Have Larry lay it out. Yeah, go ahead.
Click on the link, and you're going to see the entire file. Yeah, right there. Yeah, click on the link. Because this is what blew me away. You know, this is from the, no. Back.
Okay, hold on.
You clicked the wrong link. You clicked the wrong link.
Okay, hang on. I got to come out of all this.
That's because you got a Mac.
See what happened.
You clicked the wrong link.
I sure did. Hit me,
You want me to pause it?
Wait, I think it's in. I got it. We're right there. I'll edit all this.
Wow.
Okay, back to Earl Cabell. And this one here. Full screen.
You know, Judith found, I told you, she found a document that I corroborated, I verified, you know, about the gun shipments, you know, from San Juan, from Puerto Rico via Venezuela, you know, 758 rifles, you know, which isn't exactly what happened when she was in New Orleans, but at least it parallels, you know, it sort of confirms, you know, that there was that kind of operation going on, you know, from supplying armament from Venezuela to the Cuban exiles, either in
San Juan. Even shows in her book what page that she predicted or reported on that.
That's right.
Kind of parallels. You're right about that. Now, Earl Cabell, of course, was the mayor of Dallas, whose brother was head of the CIA military. What was his
name? Charles Cabell.
He was the deputy director of the CIA for covert activities. Charles Cabell, three-star Air Force general.
If this doesn't hit you in the face, I don't know what is going on.
I know, Larry. We want to get back to the document if Gary can get back to it. But the fact is, I spent 10 years pondering, this is from like 1971 to 1981, pondering the link between the CIA and Dallas because I knew there had to be one. And in 1981, I realized that the mayor was a brother of the lieutenant general who'd been the deputy director for plans. And that, you know, Charles was born in Dallas in 1903. Earl was born near Dallas in 1906, and I went to the library, to the archives for New College of the University of South Florida and found a Who's Who for, as I recall, 1965. And when I read their bio sketches, I was just stunned by how blatant and obvious it had been. And now here, Larry, we have further documentation. Not only was his brother CIA, Earl Cabell, the mayor of Dallas himself, was CIA as well.
Hey, that's a 201 file, you know. 201 file, that's exactly the evidence that we're talking about here, you know.
All right, so you want to read it, Dr. Fetzer?
Well, I can't see it, Gary.
I can't see it. It's not on screen share.
Ah, that's right. I got to hit screen share. Sorry about that. We'll be right back.
I think this is one of the most fucking incredible documents in this whole batch here, Jim.
Yeah, you use a bit of French there, my friend.
I don't know how.
This one blew me away. It just blew me away, Larry. Right. When you read it, it's just.
Earl Cabell was CIA. We all know that General Charles Cabell was fired by JFK along with Richard Bissell and Alan Dulles over the Bay of Pigs fiasco in April 1961, an operation that JFK had inherited from the Eisenhower administration. On November 22nd, 1963, the mayor of Dallas was one Earl Cabell, the brother of Charles Cabell. Some conspiracy theorists believe this was quite convenient for those who set up JFK for the hit in Dealey Plaza. It goes much deeper than this. This newly released file proves that Earl Cabell had been CIA since 1956. And there's a number for the file. Here is his secrecy agreement. I acknowledge the fact that because of the confidential relationship between myself and the U.S. government, I will be the recipient of information which in itself or by the implications to be drawn therefrom will be such that its unlawful disclosure or loose handling may adversely affect the interests and security of the United States. I realize that the methods of collecting and of using this information, as well as the identities of persons involved, are as secret as the substantive information itself, and therefore must be treated by me with an equal degree of secrecy. Two, I shall always recognize that the U.S. government has the sole interest in all information which I or my organization may possess, compile, or acquire pursuant to the understanding. No advantage or gain will be sought by me as a result of the added significance or value such information may have due to the government's interest in it. Three, I solely pledge my word that I will never divulge, publish, nor reveal, either by word, conduct, or by any other means, such information or knowledge as indicated above, unless specifically authorized to do so by the U.S. government. Four, nothing in this understanding is to be taken as imposing any restrictions upon the normal business practices of myself or my organizations. That is, information normally possessed by us or gathered in the regular course of business will continue to be utilized in accordance with our normal procedures. Signed, Earl Cabell, 17 October 1956.
Wow. That's all it took was one of these, huh?
You know, every now and then, you know, you find one of these nuggets in there, you know, and this changes the whole complexion, you know, as far as I'm concerned, because when you have Mayor of Dallas, CIA, I think he's going to control just about everything that's going on, you know, and
makes it much more difficult for anyone to insist the CIA wasn't involved in the assassination of JFK when the mayor himself was CIA.
Yeah. Hey, they're going to have a hard time refuting that one, Jim. You know, I don't know, you know, but, you know, it's going to be tough for them, you know.
So which one? Incredible.
Let's talk about Randy Adams. I mean, because this deserves, you know, this kid, you know, this guy was picked up, you know, over the murder of a Dallas Police Department officer, you know, during a traffic stop. And this kid, you know, who was just a sociopath, you know, 16-year-old kid, you know, who stole the car, picked up a gun, and he killed this cop. And then he gave this guy, Randall Adams, a ride, you know, in Dallas, you know, and after he dropped off Randall, he went and he killed his cop, you know. So when they started to prosecute the case, he went and he fingered, you know, Randall Adams, and he went to jail for life, you know, because this other kid, you know, 16-year-old kid, had fingered him, you know. So anyway, they did a documentary in 1988, and based on the information that came out of this documentary, you know, Randy Adams was acquitted, you know, and he was released from jail. You know, the story is really incredible. You know, this is Randy. If you can go down, scroll down a little bit, Gary, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about the story, because some of the people that were involved in the Dallas, in the Lee Oswald case were all also involved in this case, you know, and this is what's so incredible, you know, about, you know, the methodology that they use with Lee Oswald is prevalent exactly in this case, in the Randy Adams case. So what does the Adams case have to do with the JFK case, you might wonder? Well, it just so happens that some of the DPD players who helped frame Lee Oswald were also involved in framing Randall Adams, okay? In order to understand how a white man in Texas could go through such an ordeal, it is important to consider the notoriety of the district attorney's office when dealing with alleged cop killers. Okay, and who was the district attorney in Dallas from 1951 to 1986? Well, none other than Henry Wade, you know. Now, since then, you know, a lot of Henry Wade's convictions have been overturned. If you go to that link, you know, we don't want to go there now, Gary, you know, but if you go there, you'll see, you know, that this has been where they have been reviewing a lot of the cases, and also the DNA cases that have been left, you know, with Henry Wade, you know, where they were, you know, they sent a lot of people to jail, and they actually, people go to death row and executed, you know, over convictions from people, for people who were not guilty at the time. We all know about, you know, what happened there, but in this particular documentary, A Thin Blue Line, Adams describes his treatment at the hands of Gus Rose, of all people, after being arrested for the shooting death of Officer Wood. Now, before we go into Adams' story, it should be noted that Gus Rose was a DPD detective who was assigned the task of finding Lee Oswald's co-worker, of all people, Lee Buell Wesley Frazier. Now, I talk about Buell Wesley Frazier because I did a presentation in Santa Barbara, you know, for the 50th anniversary, and I presented a lot of new information on Buell Wesley Frazier, particularly the information on his Army records. You know, Buell Wesley Frazier was drafted into the Army shortly after the assassination, and a lot of people thought and concluded, actually, that he had been sort of like put away, you know, and they hid him away, you know, so that investigators couldn't get to him, you know, until, of course, the guy that did the assassination tapes, and you know, a lot of the information that came out of there, you know, proved that Buell Wesley Frazier had been a very, very fragile witness, you know, 19 years old, you know, and at the end, you know, Buell Wesley Frazier, you know, turned out, you know, now that, you know, in later life, you know, he's been saying exactly what he felt, you know, all along. And we're going to cover that, you know, right now. So Buell Wesley Frazier disappeared about 6 hours that day. And the VPD was frantically looking for him because he had given Lee a ride to work that morning. Now, when Gus Rose finally caught up with him, he took him and his sister, Lenny Mae Randall, to City Hall to sign affidavits. After they were done, they were allowed to go back and were almost back in Irving when Captain Fritz radioed the detectives to go back and bring him back for a polygraph test. And this is a polygraph test that has disappeared, completely disappeared. Okay, now this is some information that's in Jim Bishop's book, you know, the day that Kennedy was shot. And the reason that I put it here is because this is the only information that we know about Buell Wesley Frazier's polygraph test and how it was conducted. And we don't even know what was in it because it's completely disappeared.
Go ahead. Yeah, Larry. I just have to ask you, what do you make of Captain Will Fritz trying to get a confession out of Wesley Frazier?
Well, that's what we're going to cover that in right now, a little bit further down, Gary.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. So anyway, when there it is. There it is. Go on. In 2013, July 13, 2013, Buell Wesley Frazier was brought to the sixth floor. And go ahead. Can you scroll down a little bit?
And
this is where Stephen Fagan, you know, asked him about all this. They had him there for about an hour, you know, and he turned around the entire interview, and he started criticizing the Dallas Police Department, and at the same time he started to talk about Lee Oswald being such a good guy that there was no way he could have been, you know, the assassin, you know, and you know they're bringing him there, you know, to make Lee Oswald be guilty, and then all of a sudden he turns around the entire interview and he says, you know, Captain Will Fritz came in and he wanted to make me sign a confession, you know, and that's exactly what we're going to talk about here. Because
Larry, this is so bizarre. This is so bizarre.
I always thought so myself. It's the strangest part of the
and
case.
This is true. And Wesley Frazier, you know, and I, you know, that's one of the things, Jim, that I don't understand about JFK research. You know, when Wesley Frazier says something like this, I think this is important. You know, you need to pay attention. You know, I say, hey, wait a minute. Captain Fritz came in and he wanted me to sign a statement, you know, that I was involved in the assassination of JFK. All right.
So he told him he would punch him out. He said he would beat him
up.
That's
right. That's right. So how does what does this have to do with the Randall Adams case? Go on down. Scroll down, please. Well, Gus Rose came in and he wanted Randy Adams to sign a confession that he had killed Officer Wood. You know, and it's like the same playbook. You know, that's here.
It's also insulting.
Yeah, I know. So they're
just trying to intimidate these poor guys, these patsies, into signing confessions which have no ring of truth at all.
Absolutely right.
And the thing about this is that this is all the same playbook from Lee Oswald. You know, that's my point.
Absolutely. But look, we'll be right back. We'll talk more about this in 1 second. We'll be right back. This is a new JFK show, number 161, and we're mourning the death of Jim Mars tonight.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
That's what we were told. Most Americans never believed Lee Oswald was the lone gunman, for excellent reasons. In fact, there were at least 6 shooters who fired from 8 to 10 shots or more who are identified here. We have, finally, the solution to the greatest murder mystery in history, laid out for the world to see, proof after proof after proof. Photos were faked, the body was changed, x-rays were altered, the home movies were fixed. 15 experts contribute to a 529-page book with 1,037 photos and diagrams in black and white and color.
Hi, this is Gary King. If you'd like JFK, Who, How, and Why, and would like to support the new JFK show, then go to PatriotRadioBooks.com. That's PatriotRadioBooks.com.
All right, welcome back to the new JFK show. And we are really, all our hearts go out to Jim Mars, one of the greatest researchers in JFK. And I'm really a little down about it. So we'll just have to march on like you'd want us to do. So, Larry, you were talking about Gus Rose.
Gus Rose. So then 10 minutes later, he comes in and he puts a pistol, a revolver on the table, and he asks Randy to pick it up, you know, obviously to put his fingerprints on the gun. Go ahead, Gary. Scroll, please.
Okay. What a dumb stunt.
I know. So this is like, you know, what do they call this? The Marx Brothers, you know, 101 here. So anyway, you know, he puts it and he wants, hey, Randy says, hell no, I'm not going to pick that up. Are you crazy? You know, so go ahead. So he picks up the gun and he aims the gun at him, you know, and he's like threatening him, you know. So this is Gus Rowe doing this to Randy Adams, you know, 13 years later after the JFK assassination, following the same playbook that Will Fritz, you know, had in place dealing with Lee Oswald. So at the end, he's talking about, of course, you know, I of course told them what happened that Saturday, that I had met this kid. I kept telling him the same thing. And this is like echoes of Lee Oswald here, you know. He didn't want to believe me. Never once was I allowed a phone call. Never once was an attorney there. Now, does this sound familiar?
Yeah, certainly does.
All right.
That's very interesting, Larry. I mean, the idea that they prepare these confessions for someone who is completely innocent is really quite shocking.
That's right.
All right.
This is the one that's been you know, tearing up the internet lately, you know, the Juan Paula Baez, CRC controller. This is coming out of the new files that were released last week. And I just want to make a couple of comments about these files. Number one, there's a few comments. Number one, the PDFs are not searchable. You have to go and you have to open the PDF and go page by page and look at each and every page. A lot of the PDFs are illegible. A lot of the PDFs are complete blank files. And I'm talking about hundreds of pages, okay? Another one of the problems that I observe is that when you scan a PDF, you can control the volume of the file. In other words, the size of the can be either half a megabyte, you know, 250K or whatever. And you, this is all controllable in the software. Some of these pages are two megabytes in size, you know, which is incredible amount, exorbitant. Okay, so we're faced with a lot of different obstacles here, which appear to have been on purpose. In other words, you know, big files, you know, illegible documents, you know, does this sound familiar? You know, probably, you know, but as you go through the files, I think you're going to find that there's a lot of good information that's coming out. I believe this thing about the Juan Paula Baez, the Cuban Revolutionary Council controller, is just an incredible find here. The information. Yeah.
Larry, look how much of this is formally withheld in full. I mean, what kind of a release is it if it's formally withheld?
That's right. And go ahead, Gary, because I think this is a lot of very interesting information that we're going to cover here. Go ahead, Jim. You can go ahead here.
You want to start here?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, at the top.
The National Archives has released a batch of documents ahead of the projected October 2017 deadline set by the ARRB in 1992. In batches 1, 2, and 3 of the 18-set collection, we finally get a clear picture of the extent of financial help received by the CRC, Cuban Revolutionary Council. July 2017 release, formally withheld in full, part 1 of 18. July 2017 release, formally withheld in full, part 2 of 18. July 2017 release, formally withheld in full, part 3 of 18. In their Machiavellian quest to topple Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, the CIA assigned millions of dollars to the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which had to be managed by someone who had accounting skills, perhaps even a CPA. That person turned out to be Juan Paula Baez. A search for Paula Baez at maryferrell.org yields only 6 hits. And none of these documents come close to showing the extensive and detailed information contained in the new batch of documents. I see you have a whole lot here, Larry, that are signed by her, where she's playing a key role.
Well, those are only the only 6 documents that are at Mary Farrell, you know, and as we will see shortly here, this guy was a very, very important guy. You know, this guy is the one who managed the money, you know, and
so this is a man whose middle name was Paula.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's his last name. See, in Spanish, your surnames, your father and your mother's surnames are the ones that prevail, you know, when mentioning names. You know, for example, Juan, his middle name is not used in Spanish. Okay, so if he was Juan Pablo, you don't even use that. You say Juan Paula, which is his father's name, and Baez, his mother's name. That's how it works in Spanish.
In this latest release, we're deluged with no less than 80 different monthly reports, all following full accounting protocol covering the years 1961 to 1965. Every penny seems to be accounted for. For the uninitiated, here's a sample report for March 1964. Larry?
Yes. Okay. I think this one is an extraordinary image here, because if you look at the bottom there, $579,458.30.
Being a revolutionary looks pretty lucrative from here, Larry.
Jim, I did research today on the value of the dollar in 1964. Is it 19? I did 1963 versus today.
Big bucks.
You know what it is? Yeah. Gary, what did you say?
It's big bucks. We're talking here. It's still it's big money today anyway. Look, $500,000 to $500,000.
Eight. Whatever you see there, you have to multiply by 8. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's
$4 million.
That's the equivalent in today's money. I mean, this is so incredible. This is like, you know, what the heck, you know?
Instead of $500,000, we're talking about $4 million.
Exactly.
The equivalent.
Exactly. You know, that's big money here, you know, that we're talking about, you know.
I can imagine there may have been some lives lost over internal disputes about money.
Oh, no. Even more than that, Jim, you know, they have a special classification for clandestineness they call it clandestineness. I don't think that that word is, you know, is proper, but clandestine operations.
Yeah.
Half of the budget is spent on, I mean, clandestine operations can be anything, you know, what are you going to do? You know, I mean,
yeah. I wonder if the Black Lives Matter expense report looks something like this.
No, but look at the here it says heroes and martyrs. What the heck are we talking
about? What the hell is that? Yeah.
You know, heroes and martyrs.
Yeah, it looks like some sort of honorary, maybe like statues or memorials or whatever.
Let me tell you, you know, in all these vouchers and all these payments, they are supporting widows for years. Widows, you know, of men who apparently died in the line of duty here, you know, in the Cuban Revolution, you know, the counter-revolution.
60 wounded. What do you think that's about? The people that were actually wounded?
Yeah. This is all at the time where they're trying to, you know, take back Cuba.
Hangover from Bay of Pigs, or are these more recent injuries?
I know, but 1964, much recent, exactly. So this is why all this comes into, you know, question here. You know, what the hell is going on here? You know. Okay, get right there. That's right.
The running total at the bottom right is a lot of money. Do the math in today's dollars. Note, it's unknown, however, if that total is for the end of fiscal year in August or December. The documents suggest a well-organized, almost corporate operation whose members went all out in their efforts to remove Castro from power. The vast majority of Cuban exiles mentioned in these reports receiving monies that never been mentioned in JFK research circles
You look at the list of people receiving money here from the CRC with Juan Pablo Baez, you know, being the controller. And it's just mind-boggling. You know, you will not recognize any of these, you know. And that is why what we're going to look at, you know, very shortly is so important, because, you know, some of these records, you know, have disappeared. Okay. And you can scroll down, because I don't think we need to read the receipt here. These are samples of the detailed expenses and salaries that Paula Baez kept track of for his employer. And I want you to look at the deposit here on October the 3rd, $310,000. Now you multiply that by 8, and it gives you the equivalent, you know, of
$2.5 million.
I know. And this is like, it looks like a quarter. This isn't even the entire year, Jim, you know. Well, you know, this is something that we've never seen before. You know, the amount of expenditure here of the CIA and the U.S.
Yeah, this is very interesting. You got a list of actual names and amounts of money being allocated to them.
That's right. This is why this is so important, because this is the first time that
I'm looking for Rafael Cruz.
Yeah, I'm looking for Sturgis, Frank Sturgis.
Yeah.
By the first guy in the number 4, the guy's making the bucks, huh?
And Marita Lorenz.
How you say this one here?
Yeah, you know, what this means is that these people were handling big bucks, you know, and the CIA was allocating big freaking bucks, you know, to Cuban.
Yeah, well, this guy here was making a lot more money than old Carlos Rodriguez Santana down here.
But the importance of these reports is, let me tell you what the importance is. Because we can measure historical events versus these reports. Because, for example, the April 1961 report is 62 pages long. And what does that coincide with? The Bay of Pigs invasion. So we're able to see, you know, how these people were moving their money, you know, and who they were paying, you know, and if they were paying mercenaries or whatever, you know, for the Bay of Pigs. And that's why these reports are so important, because they itemize everything that was going on in terms of financial operations, you know.
Yeah.
And go ahead, here, you can go.
Propaganda, how about that one? 20 grand?
Yeah, I love that. Look at the, okay, for example, file number 104-102-31-10012. That's the one that I was just talking about, coincides with the Bay of Pigs operation. and the data contained in these reports will probably take months to analyze. However, a clear pattern emerges showing activity which seems to coincide with historical events measurable in monies allocated and spent by the organization whose finances Paula oversaw. Okay, now these reports contain no letterhead, phone numbers, addresses of any kind. Many of them describe disbursements for clandestine operations and propaganda dissemination. So, yeah. You know, when you talk about clandestineness, yes. Propaganda, you know, that's a world, you know, that can be defined anyway. You know, I don't know. What do you guys think?
It got the most money, clandestine.
Of course, covert activities and.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Right up there behind it.
Gary, almost half the money.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they're all about, right? That's their business.
Yeah, underground, exactly.
Yeah, this delegation looks a little suspicious too.
Yeah. See what the point of bringing all this out is to show the organization that was involved here with the CRC, you know, and the Cuban Revolution.
This is just 1 month.
The CRC, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, actually came about because of all the bickering between all the different factions of anti-Castro exile Cubans, you know, and they wanted to bring them all under the same umbrella, and that's what the CRC did, you know. So, you know,
down to the janitorial services.
Exactly. That's right. Propaganda.
Yeah. Expense budget, Cuba.
Yeah.
Expense adjustment.
All new documents, you know, just came out last week.
Wow. Just imagine the amount of money they spend on it today.
You know, I think that the thing that we need to assimilate from this exercise here, when you translate this into today's dollars, you're talking about, you know, just incredible amounts of dollars. You know, the factor is eight, okay? And that's something that really needs to be taken into account.
Yeah, it looks like the CIA is in the book business down here, if it looks like it to me. Purchase 1,000 books.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to find out what these books are. Cuba 17.
Well, the Powder Bay of Pigs, Gary.
Yeah.
Wow. Telegrams of propaganda on account of prisoners. That's a little strange.
So, considering that increased spending could indicate an operation of some kind, we began to wonder about the key months of October and November 1963 and how expenses would compare to other months. Now, the amount of data could certainly allow us to look for patterns, and here's the actual directory.
Wow.
The year to which they correspond.
Yeah, you got to put them in chronological order.
I know. Well, you know, that's just computer glitch. But if you look at them, you'll see that there is a consistent pattern, you know, from 1961 all the way to 1965. Okay. And if you look for October 1963 and November 1963, they are not there, Jim. And this is just something that, you know.
Very good. That's why they mixed up the order, Larry. So it wouldn't be obvious initially that those months are missing.
Well, I noticed that in the chronology, you know, the numerical order of the files, those are missing as well. So
it's ridiculous that they wouldn't be in chronological order. That's the obvious thing to do.
Well, you know, I went through them, you know, and I just labeled them as I went, and this is what I came up with. And I think this is something that's pretty significant because
you're telling me no November 1963.
They took the month off, Gary.
I looked at some of these
files. That was vacation time.
Listen,
my ties in Tahiti.
I looked at some of these files, and some of them had vouchers for travel vouchers, for example, to Washington, D.C., you know, and things like that. So what we're looking for, if we ever get those files that are missing October and November, to maybe, you know, hey, you know, trips to Chicago and Dallas, maybe, you know, and who are the persons that, you know, that traveled, you know, those vouchers, you know.
Sort of like the flurry of phone calls with Jack Ruby's, things like that, but on
I suspect they'll never be released, Larry.
Oh, well, you know, well, at least, you know, the thing about this is that they have released a batch of files, okay, and with a certain pattern, a certain,
right,
okay, but those 2 months are not there, you know.
It's actually incredibly suspicious that those 2 months are missing.
Exactly, you know, I mean, it's like, you know.
There's circumstantial evidence here that big things were going those 2 months.
Yeah, Dick Tracy 101, you know what I mean?
Like, right.
The closest months are September and October and December. And you know, and the thing is that these reports are so organized and they are so specific that, you know, you can go month by month and say, wait a minute, you know, these 2 months are missing, you know, obviously, you know, so, you know, it's up to the investigators and the researchers to find out, you know. My poll has been very bland, very generic. You know, I'm just saying, look, these two files are missing. You know, what about them? And that's it.
Got a lot of stuff on your blog, Larry. Impressive.
Yeah. Well, that's why hopefully, you know, those people at JFK Facts, you know, can look it over, come over and look at some of the stuff, the other stuff on the blog there, you know. And for example, the man in the doorway, you know, which we have proven to be Lee Oswald.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of minutes left. Anybody have anything else they wanted to do?
Well, we're actually that close to an hour. The sand glass.
It looks like 10 minutes at least to me.
Well, I just want to say that Jim Mars, you know, I never met him before. I met him just this past November, you know, and I was very honored, you know, that he would at least recognize, you know, me and acknowledge me and say, you know, that I had done a good job, you know, with the man in the doorway thing, you know, and we're all going towards the same place, you know.
Well, I think it's wonderful that he finally decided to join the OIC. At one point, he and I discussed it, and he told me that while he believed that Lee had been in the doorway, he felt that because of his role as a journalist, that it would be too much in the direction of advocacy for him to join the organization. But I think that was, you know, just wrong. That it was very appropriate that a man with his background, experience, research into JFK ought to declare himself on that rather crucial issue. So it's very good that he did.
Yeah, and it was a turning point when he did, Jim, because at that time, you know, the OIC was in sort of like some turmoil, you know what I'm talking about, you know, and when he came aboard, you know, it's sort of like it gave us
things had settled back down.
Talking about Dr. Norwood, yeah, around that time when Norwood was pulling his stunts.
I was sure astounded by Norwood. I'm just dumbfounded over that, even in retrospect today.
Yeah, I remember you held him in very, very high regard, as we all did. So, all right, do y'all want to take on another witness? I have the Newmans all lined up if y'all want to do one.
Sure,
go ahead.
Okay, here we go.
That's a good one.
Well, this one we did already. This is going to be the Newmans coming up.
Yeah, we already did Price, yeah. We need the Newmans, yes.
Depository building, but I can't buy that right now. That's about it.
May I have your name, please, sir? Bill and Billy, tell me what you saw and what you felt, what happened to you.
We just come from the left field. I just seen the president and the first lady, and we were just in front of the triple underpass on Elm Street, and we're at the edge of the curb.
Time on. Gary.
Gary, Larry wants you to hold it. Stop it. Yeah. Gary, Larry wants you to hold it there.
He's wearing, notice that he's wearing a brown plaid shirt, okay? It's very important because, see, he's wearing a brown, not the same plaid shirt that Gorilla Man is wearing. He's wearing a brownish plaid shirt, which I had to research, you know, in order to put him into the blender scene, you know?
So some people have said that it was Bill Newman in the plaid shirt?
No. I'm just saying that Bill Newman is wearing a brownish plaid shirt, not the red plaid shirt that Gorilla Men.
Right. Okay, here we go.
Just for a matter of identification.
At the edge of the curve. Getting ready to wave at the president.
So you were down under the viaduct, so to speak, weren't you?
Yeah, we were halfway in between the grass. Underpass, we were at the curve when the incident happened. But the president's car was some 50 feet still here. In front of us coming towards us, and we heard the first shot, and the president, I don't know who was hit first, but the president jumped up in his seat. And then as the car got directly in front of us, well, a gunshot apparently from behind us hit the president in the side of the temple.
Do you think the first gunshot came from behind you, too?
I think it came from the same location. Apparently back up on the mall, I don't know what you call it.
You should think the shot came from up on top of the viaduct toward the president. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. And not on the viaduct itself, but up on top of the hill, a little mound of ground near the garden.
Mr. Where were you on November 22nd, 1963?
All right.
Remember, when they talk about first shot and all that, that means what they took to be the first shot. Because, you know, these shots were being fired with silencers. Jack had already been hit in the back before Alton's took the six. Then he's already been hit in the throat. And the sound of the firecracker, of course, is a bullet passing through the windshield. So, you know.
Mormon took a picture of the TSDB before, you know, she took the official photograph, which we all credit her for, you know, but that one disappeared.
It did.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he did. Because it didn't show anyone in the 6-4 window.
That's right. Exactly.
Or maybe it showed something below, like in the doorway area.
No.
Yeah, no doubt about it. He did point to his temple, just like the press secretary right there. So
right.
So this is Charles. Isn't this Charles Brennan?
Charles Brem.
Yeah, Brem. That's it.
I had taken my 5-year-old son downtown to see the presidential parade. This is a picture taken by Mr. Nix of the limousine at the time the shots were fired. Do you see yourself and your boy in that picture?
Yes, sir. This is myself and this is my son on this frame here where the first shot hit the president. I would say that he was possibly 30 feet away when the first bullet struck, moved a little closer, and was possibly 20 to 25 feet away when the second bullet hit.
Did you see the effect of the bullets upon the president?
When the second bullet hit, there was the hair seemed to go flying. It was very definite then that he was struck in the head with the second bullet. And yes, sir, I very definitely saw effects of the second bullet.
Did you see any particles of the president's skull fly when the bullet struck him in the head?
I saw a piece fly over in the area of the curb where I was standing.
And in which direction did that fly?
It seemed to have come left and back.
In other words, fired from in right front. He might even be talking about the Harper fragment. Remember, you got the motorcycle cops talking about one of the Secret Service agents picking up a chunk of skull and throwing it in the back of the seat. That may very well be the Harper fragment that was brought back the following day to be discovered by Billy Harper.
Not only that, his kid picked it up. And
it was kid from whom the Secret Service agent took the chunk of skull. Is he gonna talk about this here?
Yeah, as per Stavis Ellis, at least he talks about the chunk of skull falling at his feet.
Yeah.
And the hair that went flying.
Yeah.
This is a serious interview.
And because he said there was only like 5 feet difference between the two shots, that with a vehicle moving, 5 feet is, you know, very, very brief. It would already, if he were what he's saying were correct, if the vehicle were moving and it had only moved 5 feet, that would have meant the shots were too closely spaced to have been fired by the bolt-action Mannlicher Gargano, which required 2.3 or more seconds just to manually operate the bolt.
Well, you know, later on, Brehm recanted, you know, and his
yes.
Yeah, the very first reports that came out on the Dallas Times-Herald where he said, you know, that shots came from in front of the president, you know, and then after that, you know, they worked on him, you know, and he totally went 180 degrees, you know.
He was given the word, huh?
Yeah.
Of course.
Was very upset with Mark Lane, very upset about this interview, and he did
it. Right. I know. And then he said that, you know, Mark Lane had put words in his mouth, you know, and this and that. Yeah, I know.
Right. It's terrible. We should play that very, very soon. Here we go.
To the left and to the rear of the presidential limousine. Sir, whatever it was that I saw did fall, both in that direction and over into the curb there.
You were a ranger during the war, correct?
Yes, sir, I was a ranger during the war. Took part in the invasion of France and was
shot. That was a ranger, for crying out loud.
he got shot a few times, he's about to say, so he knew what gunshots were all about.
Let's just say it's possibly like swimming. I hadn't heard that sound for many a year, but you don't forget it once you've heard a shot round and coming close to you.
Did you speak with newsmen on November 22nd and tell them what you saw?
Yes, sir. And told them simply that there were two shots had hit the president and the direction that I had thought the bullets had come from.
Did you at any time that day make a statement which was televised?
Yes, sir. Fortunately, I was probably 15 to 20 feet away from the president when it happened.
Tell us exactly what you saw, sir.
He was coming down the street, and my five-year-old boy and myself were by ourselves on the grass there on Commerce Street, and I asked Joe to wave to him, and Joe waved, and I waved, and the man.
That's all right, sir. You were coming.
Because he was waving back, he was the shot rang out and he slumped down in the seat and his wife reached up toward. He was slumping down and the second shot went off and just knocked him down from the seat. I'm positive it hit him. I hope it didn't, but I'm positive that it hit him and he went all the way down in the car.
Yeah, he was talking about that slump quite a few times. How he slumped over that you. Talk about
something. Well, after the first shot, he slumped forward and Jack eased him up. And then after the second, he slumped to the left.
All right, let's finish up with this witness and we'll call it a night.
Teed it up and I didn't know what was going on, so I just grabbed the boy and fell on him in hopes there wasn't a maniac around.
He didn't even know when the limo stopped. He doesn't even know when the limo stopped because he says it himself. You know, he jumped on his kid, and he didn't know what was going on after that.
Yeah, he was protecting his son.
Did you make a statement to the Dallas Sheriff's Office?
Yes, I did.
How long did you remain in the Dallas Sheriff's Office that day?
I was, say, about 3 hours to 4 hours.
Were you among the closest witnesses to the limousine when the shot struck the president?
Yes, sir. I would have to say that if not the closest, one of the closest to the unfortunate incident, I did get a view of something.
Being one of the closest witnesses, of course, the Warren Commission would not want to call him.
I'm sure he's about to say that.
The Warren Commission. No, I was not called by the Warren Commission to testify.
How did I know that? All right, we'll go ahead and call it there. Now, any closing comments, Larry and Jim?
No, it's been, we're honoring Jim Morris. You know, I thought, you know, perhaps we could do a minute of silence. Maybe we can do it now, you know. And
certainly.
Jim, do that.
Good idea. In memory of Jim Morris. He will be missed.
Yes, sir.
All right. This is the new JFK show number 161. Rest in peace, Jim Mars.
Did you know that Sandy Hook was a staged event where no children died? That the school had been closed since 2008 and there were no children there? 13 experts, including 6 PhD, current or retired college professors, proved that it was a two-day FEMA drill presented to the public as a real event. We even have the manual. There was a rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th. Some participants became confused and put up donation sites the day before. Even the shooter was recorded as dying before the event. You have been played by Eric Holder and Barack Obama. Now Hillary wants to extend the deception by posing as a champion of Sandy Hook to confiscate your guns. Don't let yourself be played. Nobody died at Sandy Hook.
If you want to get a grip on just what fake news is, then I'd suggest you get the book, Nobody Died in Boston, at PatriotRadioBooks.com. That's PatriotRadioBooks.com.